Access number 29065, Mr. Michael White, Reel 6. Now, when you first got to the Gun Club barracks, well, or rather when you first got to H Troop, you appear to have been in the stores for a little while. Do you remember much about that?
Well, basically, I was only in the stores for about 2 weeks as such. What was actually in the stores, there were all these things like all the different spanners and all the tools all connected with the Bofors gun and that, you know, like the spare barrels and things like that. But at that period, the gun crews were mostly regular soldiers, and as such, they had to go on to these tests for the gun crews, so that if they kind of passed it as such, they got like an extra star, which would meant a few shillings actually on their pay as such. So basically, I had very little to do with the actual Bofors. Other than when, of course, in the Kai Tak airfield on Hong Kong and Kowloon side, they had a couple of rows of these aeroplanes, which were kind of like these were transport planes, and they actually belonged to the Chinese. Now, when the Chinese communists more or less defeated the Chinese nationalists as such, and I believe the nationalists actually fled to Taiwan, or Formosa, I believe, as it was in those days, that they were uncertain of who these actually planes belonged to, and there was great concern at that time that kind of say that if the British authorities actually handed over these transport planes to the Chinese nationalists, they were frightened that the Chinese communists would perhaps come over and perhaps bomb them or try to destroy them. And vice versa, that if the planes were then given to the Chinese communists, that the nationalists would try to do some sort of similar happenings to them as such. So during that early period of Hong Kong, there was people started, they used to have these talks with the authorities of what they're going to do with these planes. And then, so when these happened, there was always concern that kind of there may be some sort of air warfare or something happening from either the Chinese nationalists or communists. So the ACAC of Hong Kong used to kind of disperse around kind of the colony, and the Bofors as such, they used to be go to different positions. And what happened then?
How would you deploy to a Bofors gun?
The actual what used to happen then? People used to be running around shouting "Mad dog, mad dog!" And of course, to newcomers like say ourselves, sort of thing, we didn't know really what it was all about. But what it meant that kind of like all the Bofors gun crews, they would all kind of they would pack all their kind of equipment and even ammunition as such into the 3-tonne vehicles. Now the 3-tonne vehicles, they were not the canvas tops. They had all special compartments and boxes where the tools fitted in, the ammunition could fit in, and also the spare barrel as such. And then kind of the Bofors then was a towed type, and that was towed beyond this 3-tonne to the different dispersal parts dotted all around the Crown Colony. And so also you had to put a tent in there and all things like that, so we didn't know how long it was likely to be. So then we actually went to different positions, and some was round kind of like the waterfront areas and kind of to protection sort of thing. They used to build up, they used to have these ammunition boxes full of soil and things like that, so you could more or less to semi protect the gun. And the actual idea was to try to form some form of an umbrella coverage, because these Bofors, these were the old World War II types, which were manually operated. And so you form this coverage, and I suppose that you kind of just fire shells actually into an umbrella area, things like that.
Because you couldn't aim at a jet, it was too slow moving.
Because this was the period when the changeover was beginning between kind of like the piston or the turboprop aircraft over to jets and things like that. And so when with my gun, we was number 8 gun sort of thing, we was actually dispersed to some area, and we had to get up this big heavy gun up this kind of this quite a big kind of slope sort of thing. We tried manually operating, pushing it up there and things like that, and of course it was kept running back very dangerously and things like that. So in the end, the troop sergeant major, he turned up with a jeep, and he connected to it, and Cusby, he had to put it to a very low gear, so he went into reverse, which was the lowest gear of all on a jeep. And with him towing it in bottom gear and us kind of pushing it, we eventually managed to get up to this, well, it seemed impossible position and things like that. And then kind of once we were up the top there, we had to dig this huge great big pit. And of course, it's quite a large gun. And so we was digging all through the day and most of the night digging this huge pit. And then, of course, I was kind of like one of the new intake onto this gun sort of thing, and I with someone else, we then had to try and put this tent up sort of thing, and of course I got no idea whether it was like a round bell tent or a ridge tent or what have you. And so we struggled up through the night and things like that. And so that is what I actually remember. Now, usually when these talks actually finished, we all had to kind of come back to barracks as such. And so we then spent the next couple of days kind of cleaning all the equipment and things like that. And so that was the end. And I think that happened on at least two occasions, what I remember, during my period in Hong Kong.
Now, did you actually do any gun practice? You were on the... You were number 8 gun, but yeah. What was your role in the gun team? Or did you not really have one assigned? You were meant to be a driver, weren't you?
No, the reason I did not become driving actually in Hong Kong as such at that time...
No, you've explained. What I mean is you weren't a trained gunner, so what did they have you doing on the gun?
Well, the reason I was transferred to the guns, because when we got to...
You've explained that, yeah.
When we came back to 4-2 batch, they had no vacancies as such, so I was actually... We was actually transferred to the guns, and of course... I was number 8 on the gun, which is kind of like more or less perhaps an ammunition part and things like that. I mean, there were people kind of like there was sighting the gun and firing the gun, and there was they used to put so many clicks on kind of if the plane was going about 400 miles an hour, where they could hopefully shoot in front of the plane, hopefully the plane would run into it. So basically my experience really of the both is very, very limited.
And did you do any actual gun practices?
Every so often, they used to tow the guns up into the new territories of Hong Kong, because we was actually based in gun club barracks in Kowloon. And so we used to go to a place, I think it was called Port Shelter, and this is where they used to have this range. And sometimes they used to have these planes, they used to kind of tow these, what they call a sleeve. It's kind of equivalent to, say, like a long kind of rope, for better words, and then this kind of this thing used to hang behind, and this is what they used to fire at the sleeve sort of thing, and hopefully not shoot the plane down.
Now, what was life like in gun club barracks? What were the actual barracks themselves like?
Well, the actual barracks, it was, I think it was a pre-war type barracks, but all the buildings, they were all kind of white, and I think they were two-storey high with flat roofs. They had all the facilities in the rooms as such, the bedrooms, that I think there were two-tier things, and they was made up, the bottoms were made up with kind of about four or five boards or planks as such, and then on top of that was placed kind of a palliasse mattress, and then kind of like whatever, because it was reasonably warm in those days, so you didn't really need much covering, things like that. And I think if I remember rightly, they either had a box at the bottom of the bed or maybe a locker. I can't quite remember that. And there was very few what I call kind of inspections as such, where they're the occasional inspections, but very, very few, because most of the people actually within the battery, there was only a small amount of national service, and most of them were actually regular soldiers who used to kind of what they call on a 3-year python. This is when kind of like the battery or the regiment went abroad for about 3 years as such. So these regular soldiers, they were not too happy about us newly national servicemen who'd kind of been so used to kind of all this bullying in kind of during training. But the rest of the actual barracks, there was a small kind of a parade square, as I remember. But most of the guns, they had these, all these guns were actually in these sheds as such, and same with the actual also the three tunners.
And now, was there a problem with insects or insect infestation in the barracks? Because there was in some of them.
We were actually issued with mosquito nets, but during the whole of that period, because we were kind of like near the waterfront as such of Kowloon, and so I cannot ever really remember kind of using mosquito nets. But our clothing, we had kind of like the so-called jungle green, as it was called in those days, which was kind of like we used to wear shorts in the daytime with kind of like putties and hose tops, and also kind of the jungle green jacket as such. We used to have all our sleeves rolled up. But when it came to about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we had to transfer back into long trousers, and also we had to bring our sleeves down with actually... because of, you know, potential mosquitoes. But every morning, actually on the square, when we prayed it, I think it was around about 9 o'clock, if I remember rightly, we used to line up, and the officer and the sergeant major sort of thing used to come round, and he used to have this either big bottle or a big tin of paludrin tablets, which are anti-malarial. And because most of these, a lot of them would perhaps not kind of swallow them as such. So he used to kind of come along, and he used to make everyone open their mouth, and the sergeant major popped it in, and he made sure that you actually took this paludrin tablet.
Now, what about bugs?
Bugs. Now, actually, in the beds, with these wooden planks as such, they used to have these so-called bed bugs, and so. Underneath these, the 4 feet of the actual bed, we used to have these 50 cigarette tins. These are the tins which used to have 50 cigarettes, and which I can't remember whether they're actually issued free at that time, but they're obtainable. And so we used to put a certain amount of paraffin or something similar liquid in them, and we used to place each one under the actual the four feet. And then I think every so often, so many weeks or about a month, I can't remember now, people used to go out onto, we used to have a veranda in front of the, because we was on the second floor, what I remember, and you used to get these planks, and we just used to bounce them actually on the concrete things, and if any bugs came out, sort of thing, you used to just squash them with your feet and things like that, and then you just put them back, and then it was back to normal until next time and that. But I can't ever really remember being bitten by any bed bugs at that time. But the bed bugs did actually used to come out of these planks and things like that.
Now, what about the food? What was that like?
Now, the food in Hong Kong, I mean, it was quite good, as I remember. And there was no fatigues as such, where kind of like the ordinary squaddie used to go and peel potatoes and all things like that, and wash all the pans up and things like that, like that may have been when we was training, because there used to be quite a large Chinese workers actually within the camp, and they used to do all the dirty jobs and all the things like that. But all the cooking was actually done by the Army Catering Corps.
And what was the food like?
But the food, as I actually can remember, I mean, it was quite good. I can't really remember after all this, about nearly 50 years, what it was like. But the one thing I always remember, we used to have around about 11 o'clock, we used to have what we call a naffy break. And we used to go down to the naffy, and they used to serve this tea in these big pint glasses, thick glasses, things like that. And also, they used to make these marvellous big sausage rolls, and they were really good. But these were all kind of made and kind of cooked by the Chinese workers actually in there. And also within the camp as well, the Chinese, they used to do all the laundry. And of course, it was called Dobi, which was a new name to me in those days and things like that. So every time we used to pack all our bits and pieces up, and then it used to kind of be collected, and then the Chinese would wash it and iron it and things like that. And then the Chinese did all this. And of course, there was quite a few Chinese in there. They used to have like little shops in there where they had used to sell things like films. And I think there was one gentleman, he was a watch repairer, and he actually mended my watch, as I remember.
Did you actually have servants yourselves? I mean, or was there a servant in your room?
No. We were the so-called common soldiers, such. Now, the officers, they had what they called batmen, but this batman was some person who was kind of like had actually volunteered to do his chores, like, I suppose, his ironing his equipment and ironing his trousers and what have you, and cleaning his boots or shoes and that, and of course the reason some of them actually used to volunteer was because, I mean, they would be void from going on any kind of parades as such. And also I think the officers did actually pay them some sort of a fee and that.
Now, what was life like living in Gun Club? I mean, what did you have any opportunity to get into Hong Kong to see the sights?
Now, we were very lucky, really, being in Gun Club Barracks, because we was quite near to, we was in a short walking distance of the Star Ferry, which took you over to Hong Kong Island as such, and also there were plenty of these big red double-decker buses going around. And also, as you kind of walked down, there was the big Peninsula Hotels, which was one of the major hotels in those days of Hong Kong. And then also a short distance down was a large Naffy Club, so where you could actually go into this Naffy Club, and they had like snooker tables, and I think there was also, you could have kind of, they used to cook meals and all rest and relaxation and things like that, which was, it was very good for the so-called British soldiers at a Hong Kong posting, especially if you was down either on Hong Kong Island or down in what are called Kowloon. Now, there was a large contingent of soldiers as such, because after the Chinese communists...
You've done that, yeah, you mentioned
now,
that.
After the Chinese communists actually captured kind of like the...
You've done that, yeah. Now, you did that last time. Now, what about...
I was going to mention about kind of up the top end sort of thing. This is where the infantry soldiers was, and also the 25-pounders, and kind of they used to go on these kind of manoeuvres as such with the view of kind of...
Now, getting back to recreations, what would you do? Would you go on the ferry to Hong Kong Island? What was it like?
Well, the actual ferry boats, and I believe they're still operating now, are going across from Kowloon to Hong Kong Island as such. They were kind of like two levels or two stories high. Now, in the 1950s, when the British troops were there, that the British soldiers always travel what they were classed as first class, which is on the top deck or the upper deck, and all the Chinese, which many of them were mostly very, very poor sort of thing, and they always travelled on the lower decks. Now, this was very similar to on the Hong Kong Island, where they had trams. And the same thing applied there, that any of the British soldiers and civilians, they would go on the upper decks, and all the poor Chinese would travel on the lower decks.
Now, what was it like when you got to Hong Kong Island? What would you do?
Well, we was actually based in the barracks as such, and we had a certain time there. If you was not on form of duties or kind of guards at night and things like that, you then had kind of time of relaxation. You could actually leave the barracks. There was no problems at all with leaving the barracks. The only thing that actually restricted you, especially national servicemen, was the lack of finance. Now, the regular soldiers, more or less, they got twice as much money as a national serviceman. So, but with Hong Kong, really, I mean, it was such a fascinating place with the waterfront and all the rickshaws and all the sampans and things like that. I mean, it was just a marvel for kind of national servicemen.
So you just go and look around, really?
Yes, basically go around, but also actually on the island for the servicemen, as I mentioned before, there was the big Naffy Club, which was just around the road to us. Now, on Hong Kong Island, there was another big thing called the Cheerio Club, and there was another club called the China Fleet Club, which was mostly used by the sailors as such, because there was a large contingent of Navy based in Hong Kong. But soldier sailors, you could mix to anyone. And also on Kowloon itself, there was another one called, I can't remember. remember that name.
Nine
Dragons Club. And this is where we often used to go in there. We used to
what was that like? What was he like?
It was just kind of like a club for more or less for the forces. And there was the rooms where you could relax, and also they used to do meals and things like that. And these clubs, you could kind of get steak and chips and things like that, beans on toast. You could get, I think you could even get alcohol, what I remember of, and things like that. Because you've got to realise that in 1950-51, there was all this rationing in England and things like that, and kind of things like a huge piece of steak, egg and chips, which was one of the favourites for the British soldiers, you know, which they paid for themselves, was quite a luxury.
Now, you used to take photographs for your Browning.
Yes, whilst we was actually in Gun Club Barracks sort of thing, as I mentioned before, we never had a lot of money because we was only on national service rates. Now, my good friend from Nottingham, we decided between us we would buy one of these Brownie box cameras because we bought this Brownie box camera for about 25 shillings from one of the, I can't think it was from the NAFI or from one of the shops, you know, run by the Chinese as such. And this is where they used to put a roll of film, and I think there was only 12 actually on the roll. So when we actually went out, we apart from taking photographs of ourselves, which we used to send home to immediate families, we used to go out and we used to go on and take pictures. We used to go up the Peak Railway, which was on Hong Kong Island. We used to go up on the tram car and you used to get this fantastic view. And down below in the water punt, there was all these aircraft carriers, and there was all these warships, kind of both British and American, come from the Korean War. You've got to appreciate at that time, I was just still purely Hong Kong. And also there was another marvellous photogenic place called Tiger Balm Gardens, where there's all these Chinese kind of oriental things with like pagodas and all these weird and wonderful kind of buildings. And they were very, you know, very good to actually take photographs of.
Now, I know you wanted to. One thing that was happening was, we've mentioned a couple of times, is the backdrop of the nationalist communist struggle, and the communists were winning. There were a lot of refugees, Chinese refugees. I know you wanted to talk about that. There were making their way to Hong Kong. Were they very much in evidence? What do you remember of that? Because I know you wanted to say something about that.
Yes, there was. When the actual communists, I think it was in about 1949, when they more or less took over the whole of China sort of thing, I mean, there was lots and lots of Chinese. They were not happy with that situation, and so they kind of tried to flee into the Crown Colony of Hong Kong. And because they used to have all these kind of these boats, and I'm talking about military boats kind of trying to stop them coming in, because of the big influx. But I mean, they all came in on very clever ways, you know, kind of on these sampans at night times and things like that. So when they actually arrived in the Crown Colony, they kind of dispersed themselves everywhere. And of course, they were kind of like poverty stricken. So there was must have been hundreds and hundreds of them actually living actually on the street as such. So when we actually used to go out in the evening, all these people there were on the actual streets, and you used to see that many of them used to have this kind of like just like a bowl of rice as such, and they used with some chopsticks scooping it down. And I also remember poor people, when we used to be on guard sort of thing, there used to be kind of this big lamppost near the guard kind of hut where I was there, and there used to be lots of these big beetle type things flying around, you know, what we used to call July bugs when we were children, and they used to kind of catch these sort of thing, and I suppose when they killed them, and I suppose they used them as food as such and things like that. And so when we actually also used to go out into the shopping areas of Kowloon especially, and that, and they used to have all these fantastic markets everywhere, and of course they were all these little children, and they was all working, and used to be, and I came across one place where there was these small printing machines, because I was an apprentice in printing trade and things like that, and I was amazed to see some of these little children kind of actually operating these printing machines, and we're talking maybe 10, 11 o'clock at night and that, because at that period, I mean, the weather was so marvellous, sort of thing. It was beautiful and warm, you know, up till midnight plus and that.
Now, one thing...
And also another thing that I actually remember with the actual Chinese, that of course there were lots and lots of these old coal ships used to come in, and kind of used to see, it used to fascinate me along the waterfront watching this activity, and used to see these some of these coal ships or coal barges being unloaded, and they used to have this just like a gangplank just going across, and these Chinese there were kind of like in practically just like a little black thing. They used to be barefooted, and they used to have this bamboo pole over their shoulder, and they used to have these two wicker baskets hanging down full of coal, and they'll go forward and backwards each time, and I think they used to give them a token at the end of it.
Now, I believe at one point you were considering volunteering. Before you were actually sent to Korea, there was a standing invitation to volunteer for Korea. As an individual, now tell us about that. What was that about?
Well, they after about a short period, actually in Hong Kong, my good friend from Nottingham, we actually got split up. I was actually posted to I think it was H Troop, and in Gun Club Barracks, actually, and on Kowloon side. And my good friend from Nottingham, he was actually posted with another Beaufort's troop, which was on Hong Kong Island at what they call Stanley Barracks. And so what we sometimes used to arrange, sometimes on a Saturday, we would actually meet either kind of Kowloon side of the Star Ferry or the Star Ferry on the Hong Kong Island. And so we used to meet up, and we used to kind of have a wander around and do either go to the pictures, because there were lots of cinemas dotted around, which was marvellous for the servicemen. And so one time they were always asking for volunteers for the Korean War. And kind of like perhaps being a little bit bravado, perhaps 18-year-olds, we decided, why shouldn't we kind of perhaps volunteer sort of thing, you know, perhaps for a bit of excitement or perhaps adventure. Anyway, this happened. This was around about the period of, I think it was around about April of 1951. And, of course, there were two major newspaper, English printed newspapers. I think it was called the Hong Kong Standard and the China Morning Post. And of course, we often used to see these papers, and because it was printed in English. And then all of a sudden, there was this almighty battle went on during the Korean War, when I think it was the Gloucestershire Regiment. They more or less ceased to exist. A full battalion ceased to exist. I think there only a few escaped. And of course, one of the Royal Artillery mortar batteries or mortar troop, they were actually attached to this Gloucestershire Regiment battalion. And they, of course, when they'd actually fired off all their actual bombs, of course, they got no other bombs to fire. So what they did then, they broke up their gun sight, and I think they buried the barrel, and then they then had to fight as infantry soldiers as such. And so when the Chinese actually surrounded them, and then there was, most of them were actually captured and things like that. I think there were nearly, about 1,000 British servicemen were prisoners of war during that period. And of course, all the gunners were captured. And so when we actually read this, we thought, no way we're going to volunteer to go to something like that. So we were then quite happy to stay in Hong Kong. But then just shortly afterwards, we always had, every morning, it was by law, really, we had to go and see the notice board, you know, with any further orders of that day or forthcoming thing. And of course, then suddenly within about a couple of days, there was this notice came on the notice board that 4-2 Battery was actually going to Korea. And I think one troop was going with Beaufort's, and all the other troops were going to transfer to 4.2 mortars. And so really, all our problems were solved.
Now, what happened next then? How did you prepare for this posting? I mean, they were reorganising the battery, yeah, weren't they?
So what happened then, there was all this excitement suddenly came upon, because as Beaufort's, we work on what we called ACAC, and Beaufort's as such came under what they call the Royal Artillery Field, which covers like 25-pounders, big 5.5 guns and all things like that. There were two separate contingents or things like that. And so what happened then, we all had to go on to sit this kind of, I suppose they wanted to know whether we were going to be drivers, gunners, or going on the guns or what have you. So we all had to sit this kind of intelligence test and things like that, which was kind of like mathematical. It was only reasonably simple type things as I remember and that. And so when it was actually kind of sorted out, it was we found mostly that the old soldier became gunners, the regular soldiers or drivers, and most of the national servicemen, because a lot of them were much more intelligent than the regular soldiers, and they were mostly become like signalers, and I was then instructed to become a tarer.
Now, was this with a 4.2 mortar platoon or with a Beaufort platoon?
No, this was. Each troop was decided which one it was going to be. So they decided that the troop which my good friend from Nottingham was, who was actually in Stanley Barracks on Hong Kong Island, they decided that, I think it was B troop, was going to be Beaufort's, and the rest of the battery was all transferring to mortars.
And which were you doing?
I was part of that. We was all going to be mortars. We were going to be mortars as such. So